For this morning's talk, I wanted to go over something which I was talking about last night in the question time. Sometimes that people can get quite confused about what is the proper path to follow with regards to meditation, with regards to Buddhism and developing the path of enlightenment. And I always like to bring people's attention, even in this retreat, at this time of the retreat, the fact that the basic path of a Buddhist, the basic path taught by the Buddha is the Eightfold Path. And if one asks, what are you practicing? It's really wrong to say, oh, I'm just practicing Vipassana, or I'm practicing Samatha, or I'm practicing this, I'm practicing that. The correct answer really should be that I'm practicing the Eightfold Path. And that was what the Buddha encouraged his disciples to practice. And the reason why he encouraged an Eightfold Path is because that Eightfold Path is necessary in all its factors to develop the stages of enlightenment, to develop freedom. And this is why the Buddha said on many occasions that the Eightfold Path is the best of all paths. And that he spent his whole life teaching just that much, the Eightfold Path. Sure that when you are talking about practice, you talk about the different aspects of that Eightfold Path, but you should never really forget that those aspects of a path form part of a whole, and that whole is this Eightfold Path. And if one wishes to go on the path towards enlightenment, if one really wishes to end suffering, then that is the path one should follow, which means that first of all one should know quite clearly what each of those factors are. And then one should look upon one's practice and see what parts are lacking. And if there's any part of that path which is lacking, that's where you should put some effort and try and increase one's proficiency in those weak areas. But even so, one has to understand what that path is first of all. And sometimes even Buddhists of long standing who have gone to many talks sometimes forget what that Eightfold Path is all about. And so I'm going to begin this morning by just saying the Eightfold Path. The first, as I was talking last night, is right understanding or right view, called Sammaditti. And straight away this makes a very powerful point, because sometimes people think that in Buddhism you shouldn't have any views at all. And sometimes when people come up to me and say, oh, just Eightfold Path, or you're just stuck in one particular type of view. And he said, you shouldn't have any views whatsoever. And I say, well, that itself is a view. A view should have no views. I've never seen anyone who hasn't got a view whatsoever. Even some of the great iconoclastics like Krishnamurti, they was always tearing down other views. But that itself is a view, an understanding. An understanding is that by which one comes to work with all this phenomena and all these experiences in the world. And certainly in Buddhism, the Buddha actually said there is something called Sammaditti, right understanding, the very first factor of the Eightfold Path. And what that actually is first of all, the understanding of karma and rebirth. And sometimes it's a bit difficult for some skeptical Westerners to accept karma and rebirth when they haven't got any memory or any recall of a previous birth. And so in such situations, one needs to develop what the first or the fifth of the, what we call the spiritual faculties, either through faith or through wisdom. The faith means that we have enough confidence in the teachings of Buddha, because we've tried enough of these teachings and got so many results so far. There's a sense of this works, this makes sense, that this is very interesting. That degree of faith may be enough just to take what we haven't experienced yet as very possible, and so we can accept the teachings of rebirth or the teachings of karma on faith. But better than faith, obviously, is experience, through the fifth of the spiritual faculties of wisdom, that we can understand this either through inference, or even better, we can understand the teaching of karma and rebirth through our own experience. And there's two ways of understanding the law of rebirth for oneself, here and now, in this very life. And one of them is by developing such deep meditation that you get to know the nature of the mind. In Buddhism, there are six senses, the five senses of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. The sixth sense is the mind. In this meditation we're doing now, if you follow the instructions, there will come a time when sight completely disappears, where sound turns off, where you can't hear anything, where smell and taste are completely disappeared, when even your body has gone and you cannot feel anything. And the echoes of those five senses in the thinking mind are also gone. Everything to do with the body and the five senses disappears. And what you're left with is the mind. In the same way that the present is what's left when the future and the past disappear, the mind is that which is left when all the external five senses are completely disappeared and gone. For those people who can experience that for the first time, it's weird, it's wonderful, but it's very blissful. You're coming face to face with this thing which we call the mind. When you come face to face with this thing which you call the mind, one of the insights which will be natural to you, which will be very difficult to miss, is that this mind is independent of the body. That much will teach you that rebirth is a fact. Also, by doing this type of meditation, the second way of finding out for oneself through wisdom, the truth of rebirth, through this type of meditation you do get a strength of mind which can increase the power of memory, and you can use that power of memory to go back so many months, years, back into your early life, back into the time you were born, and back into the time before you were born. It's just a lack of memory which stops us being able to even remember our childhood, let alone previous lives. But with this type of meditation, you are strengthening that mind. In the words of the Buddha, you're making it more malleable. Instead of like being like a hard piece of clay or becoming a sloppy piece of clay, it's just got that right moisture content so you can use it for whatever you wish to. So you can find out for yourself through wisdom, yeah, there is such a thing as rebirth. And with the realization through wisdom of the fact of rebirth, the whole law of karma becomes quite clear also. When you've got that context of many lives, you can work out why this life is this way. Other lives were other ways, following this eternal, universal law of karma. There you start to have a right view, which is much stronger than the right view based on mere faith. Because sure, you can be impressed by the monks you've seen, sure you can be impressed by the books which you read, but there's nothing which can replace the experience of these things when you know for yourself, yeah, this is actually true and it's right. Because of your bare experience. That starts to bring up what we call right view in Buddhism, but the right view has to go further than that. Not just penetrating karma and rebirth, but penetrating the very nature of existence, the Four Noble Truths. These are two halves to right view. One is the understanding of karma and rebirth, the other one is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. You've all heard those Four Noble Truths many times. Suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, the way leading to the end of suffering. But the Buddha actually said that if you truly understood those Four Noble Truths, you would be a stream winner. And you would know that you were a stream winner. And your life would be changed. And the interesting part is that the first noble truth, that life is suffering. So often that we think that it's that which is out there is suffering, not this which is in here. What reason why beings do not fully appreciate the Four Noble Truths is that they carve out a section of samsara, of existence, of life. They carve it out and say everything else is suffering, but not in here. And that little area which you carve out as not being suffering is where the self lives. And it's because of thinking there can be some place where there's no suffering, where there's no dukkha. That's why one does not realize fully the Four Noble Truths. It's like having a blind spot in one's vision. Everything else, yeah, you can say is suffering. This is why even sometimes these days, people say like attachment is suffering. And if I don't attach, then I'll be okay, I'll be happy. But the point is, it's not just a problem of what you attach to. The problem is also what is doing the attaching. Both ends of that arrangement are suffering. To be able to understand that truth of suffering, to see how deep it is again very difficult to do. Basically because we don't want to see suffering, we want to see happiness. Even in our culture, people ask, how are you? Say, I'm happy, I'm fine, even though you don't feel fine at all. Sometimes they ask you, well, how do you spend your Easter? Sitting on a cushion, just with painful knees, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, that's how I spend my Easter, not having any meals in the afternoon. They think you're crazy. What are you doing this for? For many people, they think you should be happy over Easter. Because that happiness is celebrated in this world, it means actually to admit to the suffering is going against the stream of the world. You're not supposed to do that. But one has, if one wants to be free, one has to go against any cultures, any fads, any streams of the world, and find truth, even if it's unpopular, even if it's not what you want to hear. The first of the Eightfold Path of Right View is actually seeing just how much suffering is in here. Sometimes even with the five senses, we think that to seeing somebody hurting, or to see something which is decaying or falling apart, that's suffering. But to see a beautiful flower, or to see a wonderful sunset, surely that can't be suffering. There's nothing wrong with that. Surely to listen to a great symphony by Mahler, or whoever else is your favourite composer, surely that can't be suffering. What the Buddha was saying, yes, it is. To see that truth of suffering is very difficult, because there's always something which we think is happiness. To see a baby being born, to see something magical and wonderful, or when two people are in love, what a wonderful thing it is to see, or whatever else it is you take to be happiness in the world. The point is, in these meditations which you are doing, you are pulling the rug under that illusion of happiness in this world. What you are doing, and this is why this meditation is so important to cultivate right here, you're seeing when all these five senses have completely disappeared, what's left. When you actually come to the mind which has been released from the five senses, it's called a prabhasara citta, a radiant, a beautiful mind. In fact, that is why maybe many of you are coming on this retreat. You've heard me talk enough about jhanas and how blissful they are. You want a piece of the action. And this is an important part of the reason why I teach jhanas. Not just for the sheer pleasure of them, but for the wisdom which arises as a result of that pleasure. Anyone who's experienced those jhanas will realize, and this is an insight, a real good insight, even though it might sound coarse to you, you realize that the pleasure of those deep meditative states is so much more enjoyable than sex, than drugs, than seeing a flower, seeing the most beautiful sunset, falling in love, anything like that can't hold a candle, as they say, to the bliss in deep meditation. And that makes you think, why? Why are those states in deep meditation just so much more delicious than anything you can see in the world, than anything you can hear in the world, than anything you can smell, that you can taste, anything that you can feel and touch in this world? When you realize the meaning of this, you realize that the bliss of the mind released from the five senses is because those five senses, even in their most refined and delicious form, are suffering. When suffering ends, that release from suffering is the cause of the bliss in meditation. You're actually realizing for yourself a very hard to see part of the Four Noble Truths, that all of everything concerned with the five senses is suffering. The most beautiful flower, the most wonderful sound of the birds chirping in the morning, compared to silence, the sound of the birds is a racket. Silence, the most beautiful sound. Emptiness, the most beautiful feeling. This is something which is hard to convince people in the world. That's why you have to do it through this meditation. Because you can't convince just by argument, you can only convince by experience. Why is it that some of the most beautiful experiences you've had already are when you meditate? Why? Why are you here in this 9 days rather than going to see a movie or going to, you know, enjoy other pleasures? Because there is something pleasurable, something deeply alluring in the ending of the five senses. There's something deeply attractive in the stopping of samsara. You're getting close to the Four Noble Truths. So this first of the Eightfold Path is actually seeing this, understanding this, becoming a true vision of the nature of reality. Obviously, right view doesn't come straight away. It's developed stage by stage as one practices meditation. These suggestions which I'm giving are suggestions which you may not have heard before, because they're looking at things in a completely different way, in a radical way, even in a rebellious way. But nevertheless, you can see them for yourselves if you look carefully enough and you experience these things. That right view is most important of all the eight factors, because it's at the very beginning, and because it motivates and illuminates every other factor. As one understands, so one thinks, so one acts, so one does. If one understanding is that going to the pub of a Saturday evening is the greatest pleasure on earth, going to the football on a Sunday afternoon is really great, if that is your understanding, then that's what you will do. And that's how you will speak. We've got a bricklayer at our monastery at the moment who tells us all about the footy matches. And because he enjoys those things, that's what he gets up to, that's what he speaks about. Now, the next factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, after right view, is right thought. Sometimes I call it right intention, because it's the basic movement before you start thinking. The basic movement of the mind is direction. And obviously, once the mind has a direction, in that way you will follow. And from the view, the understanding of life, comes the direction of the mind. And they say there's three of the wrong directions. And this is the wrong second factor of the Eightfold Path, which I mentioned yesterday. It's karma vitakka, avyapada vitakka, and vihingsa vitakka, or sometimes called karma sankappa. What this is thoughts or intentions to enjoy the sensory world. Even that, just the thoughts of your lunch later on today, is the wrong Eightfold Path. It's not according to the second factor. But any intention, any movement of the mind to renounce nekama, to give up the world, to simplify, this is going in the right direction of the Eightfold Path. And people say, why should we simplify? Why should we renounce? We're not all monks. We're not all nuns. It doesn't matter whether you're a monk or a nun. The Eightfold Path is the Eightfold Path. If you want to have peace in meditation, if you want to find out these delectable truths for yourself, if you want to become enlightened, you have to follow that path. You have to give up. You have to let go. Giving up and letting go is what this path is all about. As you understand this more and more, you realize it's fun to renounce. It's fun to let go. As a monk, you try and let go as much as you can, but people keep giving you things, so you have to give them away again. The more you have, possessions, wealth, fame, the more problems you're going to have. As one of the monks at the monastery is transcribing some of the talks from a retreat I gave here 2 or 3 years ago. He wants to print it into a book. I told him that if he prints it into a book and it becomes well known and I become famous, I'm going to change my name. So when anyone comes to the monastery, where's Ajahn Brahm? I said, no, Ajahn Brahm here. And I call myself another name. Because fame, fortune, wealth, that's a great burden. The freedom through nekama, through giving up these things, that's the way of peace. The times in your life you've really been happy in the world, isn't it a time when you've been free from possessions, free from relationships, free from the burdens of the materialism of life? This is why, like, giving up nekama is right there in the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And avyapada is like non-hating, non-ill will, non-cruelty. Because sometimes these are not actions they're talking about, these are thoughts in the mind, intentions in the mind. That thought of ill will to destroy, as I'll mention later on in the talk on the five hindrances, that can come to yourself. It can certainly come to the teacher. I know that sometimes people say that anyone who's a teacher, they're liable to get a love-hate relationship from their disciples. One retreat I was giving a couple of years ago in Sydney, a lady afterwards came up and said, sometimes in this retreat I really hated you. And sometimes I was sitting there and it was just so painful and so hard, and I used to ring the bell every 1 hour. Said, I'm sure that you were waiting an extra 5 minutes just to torture me. I'm sure the hour was up and you waited till 1 hour and 5 minutes before ringing the bell. And he said, at other times when my meditation was going really nicely and I wanted to stay long, I'm sure you rang the bell only after 55 minutes. Surely the hour can't be up yet. So you can't win as a teacher. But the point is here that sort of the ill will which you have to another person, or to yourself, or to the body, or to your meditation object, that ill will is not going along the path to enlightenment. That ill will which you have is the same as that when you say, I'm really going to watch the breath this time. No messing around this time. That's ill will towards the moment. There's two ways of calming the mind. One works, the other one doesn't. The same as I've been talking in Olamar, there's two ways of setting a child in bed at night when you want to get them to go to sleep. One way is throttling the child, grabbing it by the neck, banging its head on the pillow, go to sleep or else. Now what would happen with that child? Would that child ever go to sleep and calm down? The other way of setting a child in bed at night is to read it a story, stroke its hair, talk very softly to it, and to coax it into sleep. Two ways of calming the mind. Watch the breath. Come on, if you don't watch the breath, I'm just going to get really angry at you. I've been meditating for many years now. Or there's a coaxing the mind. Just gently, gently, patiently. This is meditating without ill will. And certainly meditating without cruelty to yourself. People can be very cruel to themselves in the meditation hall. They can sit for so long, even though their back is aching, their knees are bursting, and their mind is just all over the place. Push through, push through, push through. Sometimes that works, but not very often. Be gentle to your body, be kind to your body, be kind to your meditation object. Don't be cruel to this body. It's happened, and I tell this story in every meditation retreat, sometimes in the afternoon it's a waste of time just sitting here meditating. The mind just will not respond. Your body aches. The mind is just all over the place. If that happens to you during this retreat, put please follow this advice. Go back to your room. Go in your bed and have a sleep. Afterwards, get up and make yourself a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, have a shower, and then go and sit. Be kind to yourself. Every time I give that advice, there's always somebody comes in the retreat and said, thank you so much. The afternoon I was just getting nowhere. So I went back to my room and lay down just for half an hour, had a nice rest, relaxed, had a cup of tea, had a shower, and afterwards I got my best meditation of the whole retreat. Why? Because they were gentle with themselves. They were kind with themselves. They weren't practicing ill will or cruelty to themselves. Sometimes people think that this is a like a marine boot camp. Yeah. And the toughest ones are the ones that are going to get enlightened. And all the rest of the ones are wimps. If you're not up here by 3 o'clock in the morning, then you're just a cream puff. That's not the way to become enlightened. So remember that second noble truth, it's the intention, the direction which you give your mind. The third of the Eightfold Path, so not second noble truth, the second of the Eightfold Path, and the third of the Eightfold Path, the fourth and the fifth, is all about your virtue. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. And this is where we come to the, once you've got the direction of mind, letting go of those actions of body and speech which create problems in the world, which harm us. This whole path is a way of letting go. Once we see that letting go is the way, then we think letting go. We speak letting go. We act letting go. If you can't let go of the things which harm and hurt you, how can you let go of other things? Surely you should be able to abandon those things which you see and you know you understand. A bad karma. Sometimes we wonder why it is that a person can do bad karma, why they can steal, why they can say wrong things. They know it hurts, and it hurts them as much as anyone else. Why do they do that when they know they're going to suffer afterwards? It's because of stupidity. Here there's no reason to be stupid at all. The happiness, the bliss, the peace, it's all there if you just keep precepts. There's so much fun, so much joy, so much happiness comes from, say, just leading the life of a monk or a nun. The beautiful precepts. It's like being given a very wealthy gift. 227 jewels to wear on your body for the rest of your life. That's the 227 monk's precepts. Sometimes people say, oh, these are burdens, it's like chains around you. That's not the way it is. These are things which adorn the mind, which beautify the mind, which give so much happiness. Sometimes people like to get a flash new car or a big house or some very nice expensive clothes. It's much better to get a flash set of new precepts. Or an expensive new set of rules. These are the ones which really adorn you and give you so much happiness in life. Sometimes you ask the people, who are the happiest people that you know, that you see? Hopefully it's the monks and nuns you've got to know over the years. That's really weird, isn't it? Why would monks and nuns be happy? Why would they be smiling? When they can't do this and they can't do that. Actually, being a monk in one sense is worse than being in prison for some people. You know what I wrote about in the newsletter some time ago? One of the monks went to one of the high security jails in Perth, and once he told them what life was like as a monk, they responded to him and said, why don't you come in here and stay with us in jail? At least you get 3 meals a day there. We only feed you twice a day here. Probably if you reported me to Amnesty International, I'd probably get into trouble for starving in the afternoon. But the point is here that there's a lot of happiness, there's a lot of freedom, it's part of the path. Sometimes people complain and say, oh, you know, you Theravada monks, you're just attached to precepts and to rules, that's all. You should be free like us. I'm free, I can eat whatever I want to, whenever I want to. I can go into the pub at night if I want to. I can go into a brothel if I want to. I'm free. What a stupid idea that is. That's not freedom at all. That's being attached, being in the power of your cravings. You can do stupid things which will get you into all sorts of trouble. That's not being free at all. People in this world think freedom is the ability to follow your defilements, whereas in Buddhism it's freedom from your cravings, freedom from your desires. Not freedom to follow desires, but freedom from them. And that sort of freedom will always give you a deeper sense of contentment. And so the third, fourth and fifth factors of the Eightfold Path are always concerned with letting go of those actions of body and speech which hinder you from the peace, the bliss of enlightenment, and which stop you developing the further factors of the Eightfold Path, the right effort. In this meditation, sometimes it's hard to explain what really effort is. When I say a lot of time it's letting go, and it confuses people. I understand why it's confusing, because it confused me for many years. What should I do in my meditation? Should I put effort and really watch the breath? Or should I just let go and just wander around all over the place? They don't really know what they should be doing when they're meditating, and what the place of effort is. The place of effort is to bring you to sit down on this chair, on this cushion, on this stool. It's actually to get you in here in the first place. That takes a lot of effort. And then it's the effort to let go. It seems to be like an oxymoron, but it actually takes a lot of effort to guard the mind. The effort is that of a supervisor. The supervisor doesn't get their hands dirty. The supervisor is the overlooker. To make sure you're keeping on the path. To make sure that you're not wasting your time. It's the effort to cultivate mindfulness. The seventh factor of the Eightfold Path. Clear mindfulness. So to maintain clear awareness takes that effort. Remember those two parts of the mind I was talking about, the doer and the knower? To keep that knower bright takes effort. And then you have to let go of the doer. That too takes an effort, an intention which you have to maintain until things start to go. That effort is coarse at the beginning. It becomes more fine later on, until it becomes so fine it becomes an automatic process afterwards. The effort to program your computer. Once a computer is programmed, you don't need to reprogram it anymore unless just slight adjustments. You don't need to always be putting in that hard effort. That's why it's just like rolling a ball down the hill. You roll the ball, once it's going, you let it go. Or more aptly, like walking up a mountain until you get to the top of the pass. Once you're over the pass, then it's all downhill, there's no effort at all. There is a time for effort in this meditation, there's a time for no effort. Because what the Buddha said with effort is not always just trying and striving and gritting the teeth. He just said, what it takes, whether that's trying or letting go, what it takes to abandon those, what he called like unwholesome qualities of the mind. The unwholesome qualities being things like hindrances, ill will, depression, sort of lust, wandering mind. Whatever it takes to overcome those things which hinder you from enjoying the peace and the bliss of your mind. So this is why you do need mindfulness, the seventh factor, actually to know what your mind is right now and what it needs. Whether it just needs some kindness and some caressing, or whether it needs a sort of gentle nudge. This is what is necessary with effort. With the mindfulness, I always like to give the simile of the gatekeeper. And this is the Buddha's simile for mindfulness. The Buddha said that in the time he used to live, many of the cities had walls around them to safeguard them from attacks from neighboring cities and states. Each of those walls had three or four gates at which the king would position a gatekeeper to watch people coming in, to watch people going out, to make sure that the enemies would not come into the city. And this is why mindfulness was called the gatekeeper of your mind, to making sure the enemies do not have the opportunity to come. And if they do step in, they're thrown out straight away. That's why sometimes I call mindfulness the bouncer of the mind, like the bounce of a nightclub. That mindfulness is how right effort is brought about. You have to have right effort to bring about mindfulness, and then mindfulness uses right effort to keep out the unwholesome qualities from your mind. If they come in, to eradicate them, to maintain good qualities, and to arouse those good qualities. That's what mindfulness should be doing. Seeing what's in your mind at the moment. Is that a good quality? Or is that an unwholesome quality? Is that sort of happiness, clarity, a sense of letting go? Or is it still sort of attaching and being niggling at yourself, being upset about yourself, or upset about something else? What is the quality of your mind now? Is it wholesome, is it unwholesome? Get to know what the Buddha meant by wholesome and unwholesome states. Unwholesome states are those which are dukkha, which bring about suffering. The wholesome states, you can actually feel them, they're peaceful, they're blissful. This is what I should be having in my mind, in the sense it's going to be conducive to enlightenment. It's peaceful, it's clear, it's cool. Once you know the difference, it's quite easy to know what you need to do to bring about the wholesome states, the good states, the calm states, the peaceful states. In your meditation, you know what's unwholesome. Thinking backwards and forwards, worrying about this and that. That sense of despair sometimes which comes up in the meditation. When is this going to happen? I'm really hopeless. That's an unwholesome quality of mind. Don't allow it to come up. Catch it at the very beginning. A gatekeeper, if he sees the enemy coming in, he can stop them straight away. But if he's busy doing something else, reading his newspaper, watching the TV, by the time they get into the village, it's hard for him to find where they're fitting and get them out. You've got to catch them at the very beginning. But you know, one of the greatest ways of keeping out the enemy, the greatest way of keeping out the enemy is inviting in many friends. If you've got so many friends in there, they help you keep out the enemy. It's the same way, the best way to keep out burglars from your house is fill your house with so many good friends. And the burglars, they just can't get in, there's too many good people there. I think you understand what I mean here. The best way to overcome the unwholesome states of mind is to fill them up with beautiful states of mind. The states of mind of clarity, peacefulness, coolness, joy. If there's joy in the mind, it's almost impossible to get angry or to get depressed or to get irritated. That's why it's important to be able to cultivate the good states of mind, is to maintain the goodness, keep it there, and so it actually blocks out and keeps out that which is unwholesome. This is the job of mindfulness, it's the gatekeeper. Mindfulness has to be with right effort. This is why that sometimes that people say that just mindfulness is all you need, a one-fold path, just mindful, just be mindful, and that's the most important part of the Eightfold Path. And I always employ the simile of the gatekeeper, adapting it to, instead of a gatekeeper of a town or a bouncer of a nightclub, suppose it's a guard of a rich mansion, your mansion. And you tell the guard, because you're going to a retreat for 9 days, please look after my house. Please be mindful. And you go to the retreat, and when you go back home, you find that your house has been burgled, and all your prized possessions are gone. And you tell the gatekeeper, why did you allow this to happen? I told you to be mindful. And the gatekeeper says, well, I was mindful. I watch the burglars come in, I watch them go out. I watch them bring the truck in, I watch them take all of your video and jewellery out. I was perfectly mindful. Every moment I saw everything. Now, would you be very happy with such a God? Bare mindfulness is not enough. Not a one-fold path, it has to be an eightfold path. The God has to have right effort as well. The mindfulness has to be allied, accompanied by right effort. You tell the God, any unwholesome people who come into my house while I'm away, don't let them in. If they get in, call the police to chuck them out. That's two of the right efforts. Any of my friends, my relations, the loved ones, try and allow them to come in, invite them in. This is inviting in wholesome states into your house. And if they do come in, look after them so they can stay a long time. Feed them whatever they want. Tell them to enjoy themselves in the house, because these are the people I want to come in here. And if your friends are in your house while you're away, how can the burglars come in? Now this is mindfulness together with right effort. And with that mindfulness together with right effort, cultivating wholesome states of mind. What are the wholesome states? The best wholesome states of mind is the jhanas. These are stages of letting go. Abandoning stages of suffering, abandoning unwholesome states. It's a natural way of the mind. Sometimes say, can you become enlightened without doing jhanas? When you let go, this is just what happens. Can a tree grow without putting forth branches and putting forth leaves? It's just the way a tree is. It's just the way it grows. It's part of its natural cycle. The more you let go, the closer you get to these stages. They're not stages of attachment, they're stages of abandoning, of letting go. They're a sign that you have overcome your attachments, because there's nothing between you and these beautiful stages. This is why those stages of jhana are the last factor of the Eightfold Path, because as it were they're like a culmination of letting go. It's interesting though that in the suttas is two more factors, the tenfold path. Because after the eighth factor of jhanas, the stages of letting go, the body disappearing, is the mind becoming manifest. The next stage of the path is samma vimutti, which means perfect freedom. It's the insight which gives rise to enlightenment, the freeing of the person from samsara. This is why there's a section of the Tipitaka in the Sutta Pitaka called the Anguttara Nikaya. In the Anguttara Nikaya they get all the teachings of the Buddha and they classify them into whether it's one of this, two of that, three of that, four of that. So the three, you've got the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta. You get the three gems, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Anything to do with three is in the three section. The four, you've got the four Iddhipadas, the roads to success, the four noble truths, the four Satipatthanas. That's in the section on fours. When you get to the eights, when I first read this I was surprised. Where's the Eightfold Path? It wasn't in the eights at all. It was in the tens. Because as well as the eights, there's a ninth and tenth factor, which was added in the time of the Buddha. The ninth factor is Samma Vimutti, correct, perfect freedom. The result of the Eightfold Path is to bring that beautiful freedom, the freedom of the Enlightened One. And the tenth factor is Samma Vimutti Jhana, the knowledge of that perfect freedom. You cannot become enlightened and not know it. That's why sometimes people, weird people, go around saying, everyone's enlightened, but you just don't know it, that's all. It's really crazy, isn't it, sort of thing. Things like that. It's not what the Buddha said. Once that enlightenment happens, it's a complete change of your character, a complete change of your understanding. Something powerful has happened, you know that's happened. It's like saying you can die and not know it, or you can you can sort of fall over and break your arm and not know it. And you have to know these things. So this is actually a tenfold path. Because it brings rise to these ninth and tenth factors, Samma Vimutti and Samma Vimutti Jnana. And there is a sense that this is a gradual path. The perfection happens gradually. It's the right view is the first one which is truly perfected. That's when it becomes a stream winner. And that perfects the intention, the very movement of the mind is away from samsara. You can't help it, it's just nature. It perfects the virtue. That's why they say a stream winner is just almost perfect in virtue. Because samma vacha, samma kammanta, samma jiva, third, fourth and fifth, they're all born as the right view. And from there the effort can really start, because you know what's wholesome and what's unwholesome. Before, you're not really quite sure what you should be doing, what you shouldn't be doing. And only then can mindfulness truly sort of manifest, when it's together with the right effort. Just like that stupid guard of the house. You might be mindful, but you'd be allowing terrible states of mind to come into your mind and take away all your beautiful possessions. That's why sometimes people say they had sex with their wife and they were mindful. Did they take away all your beautiful possessions? You were mindful, okay, but you weren't wise. The right effort wasn't there. And through that mindfulness, it's obvious. It's you just let go. You abandon things. And the culmination of that abandonment, or not its ultimate culmination, but one of the fine stages, high stages of that letting go, is a state of freedom of the mind called jhana. And that, unless you are really sick and stupid, will lead to samma vimutti, will lead to the freedom. Seeing through the illusion of samsara, seeing through the nature of this mind, seeing there is no self, seeing what dukkha really is, see what anicca really is, and from that is samma vimutti and samma vimutti jnana, freedom and the knowledge of freedom. So that's the eightfold path. That's what this path is, that's what we're practicing here. So by aiming at the eighth factor in this retreat, I have to bring in all the other seven factors behind it. If I aimed at the third factor, I'd only be really bringing in the two previous factors. The higher you aim, the more you bring in. And later I'll be talking about how you can use the Eightfold Path, how it works, that the Eightfold Path turns into the ninth factor and the tenth factor, how it does give you freedom. It's the other word for enlightenment. We add Nibbana, that's like the ending, but also Vimutti. Vimutti is this beautiful word of freedom, right? Same word when you're in the prison and you've finally been paroled. When you've been in the torture chamber and at last you're free to go your way without any suffering. Freedom, Vimutti. In this world, as I said last night, early on in this talk, we want freedom to indulge our desires, our fantasies and our illusions. In Buddhism, it's freedom from our fantasies, freedom from our illusions. This is what freedom is. So, there's a question, there's a talk about the Eightfold Path this morning. Are there any questions about what I've just been saying? That's basic Buddhism, right down the line, one of the first teachings which the Buddha gave. I repeat it so often, and I don't think that any person would doubt that that's authentic Buddhism. So you know what you should be doing. There should be no doubts now about the path, whether it's Satipatthana, whether it's Samatha, whether it's Vipassana, whether it's watching this way, whether it's watching that way. As long as it's Eightfold Path, then you're on the right track. If it's One-Fold Path, be careful. It's like sort of going on one cylinder in your car. You're not going to get very far. So please fire on all eight cylinders this retreat. Okay.